and who in their blind selfishness blocked every effort to make much needed social progress in America, are the very people who are driving America towards greater unemployment and depression, and who consciously or otherwise are the most effective allies and agents that the common form has in America. Because American democracy will be strong only to the extent that we are able to solve the basic problems of the people. Mass unemployment, human insecurity, and poverty are the major ingredients out of which dictatorships are made. I was in Berlin when Hitler came to power. As a matter of fact, I was in Berlin the day the Reichstag burned, although I always have to hasten to add I had nothing to do with the fire. What happened in Germany? There were 8 million unemployed. You got your PhD from the highest schools of learning, and you got in line in the bread line the following morning. And Hitler said to the German youth, democracy has decayed. It lacks the strength and the will to solve the basic problems. Follow me, and I will give you a job building our kind of society. And when you're hungry enough and you're desperate enough, you'll listen to a demagogue. And when you get so hungry that you've lost hope, you're always willing to put your soul in chains to put some food in your stomach. And we've got to realize that democracy's got to solve these basic problems if it's going to be able to stand up in the marketplace of free ideas in the world and sell itself to the people on its merits. We have the problem finding a way to mobilize American democracy in peacetime as fully as we mobilize our productive power in war. If a nation can be mobilized to meet the needs of a nation in war, why can't it be mobilized as fully to meet the needs of its people in peace? The needs of the people are unlimited. There are millions of American citizens who lack decent houses, who lack adequate clothing, whose diet could be improved a great deal, and who lack many other necessities of life. All of the major cities in America need hospitals and schools and other facilities to provide wholesome community living. And yet, we have 5 million unemployed in America, 5 million workers who can't get jobs, and it goes up every year. Not because we're not turning out as much goods, but because the working population increases, almost 1 million new workers per year. And if we maintain, as Mr. Kaiserling, the chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, said the other day in Detroit, if we maintain the levels of 1948 production, by 1955, we will have between 10 and 12 million unemployed workers in America. Because on the one hand, technology increases the productivity of the workers employed and displaces some of those workers, and the new workers are coming into the labor market. So here we have in America these tremendous unfilled needs of people, and yet we have millions of workers unemployed. If we took on the task of meeting the unfilled needs of the American people, and we fully employed every man and woman able and willing to work, we could not meet the needs of the people in 20 years at full production. Dig up the latest census report, not the one they're taking now, but the last one. It's a little out of date, but when the new census is finally compiled, you will find that the figures developed in the 1940 census that reflect the basic needs of the American people have not changed radically. According to the 1940 census, 21% of the homes in America did not have electric lights. 30% didn't have running water. Now, these are not the homes in Asia or South America or some undeveloped part of the world. These are the figures on the United States of America in the year of 1940. 43% had no inside private bath facilities. 58% had no central heating. 55% had no mechanical refrigerators. And the list goes on and on like that. There is 20 years of work in America to meet these fundamental human needs. And yet the people go without the things they need, other workers go without employment. Our problem is not production in America. We know how to make things in ever-increasing abundance. Our problem is we don't know how to divide up abundance. We've been dividing up economic scarcity so long in America that we're afraid of abundance. America is the only place in the world where you find poverty living in the midst of abundance. In 1935, I was in China, and I went along the Yangtze and the Yellow River basin at the time of the flood, and I saw poverty in its ugly nakedness. On the streets of Hankow, where there were a million flood refugees, I saw Chinese mothers holding dead children in their arms, begging for a crust of bread or a tin cup full of rice, hoping to keep life in the bodies of the children who still clung to her ragged skirt. And I met with a group of students at the University of Yenching, near Peking. And we philosophized, we talked about politics and economics and social philosophy. And I pointed out the stark poverty which I'd seen in China, how dreadful it was. And a young Chinese student said to me, "Yes, poverty in China is horrible." But he said, "You know, we're old-fashioned in China. We're backward in China. We still cling to an old-fashioned culture and philosophy. We're so old-fashioned in China," he said to me, "that we still starve to death only when there's not enough to eat." But he said, "You in America, you are the most advanced nation in the world. You have raised Western civilization and Western culture to the highest pinnacle. You're so smart, you're so advanced, that you have achieved the kind of society where people are so smart that they know how to go hungry when there's too much to eat." Now that's precisely what happened in America. In 1929, the years that followed, we had people going hungry. And that's why there were so many people rejected by the Selective Service Medical Board, because that was the generation of Americans who grew up during the Great Depression, when people went without food because the farmers had raised too many bumper crops, when people went without shoes because the New England shoe factories had shut down because the warehouses were bulging with too many shoes, and people went without decent clothing because the textile industry had woven too much cloth and the clothing industry had made too much clothing. Poverty in the midst of plenty. Why? Because we have not learned how to distribute abundance in America. Our problem never has been overproduction. It's always been an acute case of underconsumption. The people just have never had the money to buy back the things that they have created in our factories, in our mines, in our mills, and on our farms. We get into trouble simply because we take our ability to create abundance on the production end and we gear that to the mechanics of economic scarcity on the distribution end. We've got a jet-propelled production machine and we're trying to gear it to a Model T distribution machine. And until we get a jet propel distribution machine so that productive power can be matched by purchasing power, we are in trouble. And all the philosophizing and all of the theorizing as to how our free economy ought to work in terms of the law of supply and demand will not change the basic fact that large sectors of the American economy are so controlled by powerful monopolies that the law of supply and demand never even gets off of dead center as far as bringing about a proper balance. So we've got this job of how can we mobilize abundance in peace and develop the social mechanism by which we can divide that abundance among the people to give them a greater degree of economic security. I've been saying for a long time that in most parts of the world, the four freedoms are adequate. But in America, we need what I call a fifth basic freedom. Freedom from the fear of abundance. We're afraid of abundance. We weren't afraid of abundance in war, because the war was consuming the abundance of weapons and munitions that we were producing. But the minute we get back into civilian production and people have to consume the products of American industry, we back away from abundance. It's because of the old distribution problem. President Truman said in his State of the Union message several months ago, that in 1949, the American economy turned out in goods and services $249 billion in wealth. And that by 1955, we can be creating $300 billion in wealth. And that every family in America can have $1,000 more income. Now the question is, are we going to so arrange our economic life so that in the first place we fully employ all of the workers and we create that $300 billion economic pie, and having created it, will we see to it that it's properly distributed among the people based upon their needs? The world is going to judge America. I've had an occasion to talk to people all over the world in my trips. The world will judge America not by the fact that we know how to split the atom, not by the fact that we build the tallest skyscrapers, not by the fact that we know how to make a jet pursuit ship go faster than sound. The world will judge America, and we had better judge ourselves, not by our technical progress, but by our ability to translate technical progress into human progress. When you're hungry, and when you go home at night and your children are without decent food and clothing and shelter, you can't say to little Johnny and Mary and Susie, well, it's too bad you're hungry. But just think how wonderful America is. Down at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, they are storing up the largest stockpile of isotopes that anybody in the whole world has. You can't eat that. You can't put it over the head of your children for shelter. We've got to translate the power and the strength and the wealth of America into tangible human terms. Because after all, people are the only thing that really counts in the whole world. That's what the whole fight is about. The whole basic struggle of mankind is to make progress in terms of people, is to give people a fuller measure of human security and human dignity and freedom. Republican Senator Aiken, and I emphasize Republican Senator Aiken, stated recently that in America, in 1949, there were 11 million families whose income was so low that they could not afford to buy enough to eat. Now, that wasn't made by a radical New Dealer. It was made by a very conservative, respectable Republican senator. You see, it's the old story.